Herzlich willkommen zu Saatkorn, deinem Podcast mit Inspiration für eine bessere Arbeitswelt. Hallihallo und herzlich willkommen zum Saatkorn-Podcast. Heute eine Folge, auf die ich mich sehr, sehr, sehr freue. Und es geht ein kleines Dankeschön raus an Rudi Bauer von We Are Developers. Der hat nämlich den Kontakt hergestellt zu dem Mensch, der heute hier zu Gast ist. Freue ich mich sehr drüber. Es ist Hang Li von Recruiting Brainfood. Und ich werde jetzt ins Englische wechseln, denn Hang spricht natürlich kein Deutsch. Hello Hang, welcome to the show.
Danke schön, Hero. Very pleased to be here, man.
He speaks actually German. So, do you want to speak in English or German?
I can only speak in English. I can order a beer in German, and that's the best I can do, I believe.
Perfect. So I'm super happy to have you on the show. And actually, we're kind of colleagues. What I'm doing here in Germany, and only for the German market, is something that you do on a way more international level. And actually, Recruiting Brainfood is probably known by a lot of people who also listen to Saatkorn. If not, I might say right away, just go on the website of Hang, and I will include it, of course, in the show notes, recruitingbrainfood.com. There you can join the community and you will get a very, very well newsletter each Sunday. So then you have two newsletters to read, the Saatkorn newsletter, which also is published on Sundays, and Recruiting Brainfood. So that's for advertising, but now to Hang. How did you come up with Recruiting Brainfood? What's the story behind?
What is the story? Do you know what? There's actually, I think there's two origin stories to Recruiting Brainfood, and I no longer know which one is actually true. So they may both be true, but I'm confused myself in some ways. So first origin story is the kind of the internet got really overwhelming for me personally. It was too much information. My kind of conception of it was that the internet just got too big for anybody to really handle. And you know the experience. It's like, oh, how can you consume all of this information? You click on this thing, it's a total disappointment. You click on the next thing, it's another disappointment. And then you have to keep clicking until you find the one thing after 100 things. That's amazing. And it makes you keep going again next day. And then I realized, you know what? I'm going to start collecting some of these sources that seem to consistently be the high quality sources. And I'm going to just like make sure I'm keeping an eye on these because this is where I'm getting my great education. Over time, it became very clear. I built up a database of these sources that were really powerful, really useful for me. And I guess it just occurred to me to say, you know what, if I had this problem in finding the right type of content, maybe other people in the recruiting industry had also, what is the easiest mechanism for me to make this available to other people? And I just thought, okay, maybe a newsletter would be the right thing to do. I'll just collect together what I've got and send it in an email every week and see if anybody can get value from it. So yeah, that's origin story number one on Recruiting Brainfood.
All right. So now I'm a little bit curious about story number two.
Okay, so story number two, it might have been a hedge against GDPR, man. Around 2014, I think when we started Brainfood, no, 2015, maybe Brainfood started, I was running at the time a software product called Workshape, which was a matching product for software engineers. So I was building a tech platform that was trying to connect employers directly with software engineers and do so with an understanding of what the motivations of a software person was. We visualized the motivation in a Workshape and we matched it to what the job actually was. A really cool idea and product. And I, of course, was the CEO of the product. So I had business development responsibilities at the time. And I, of course, was doing a lot of email to hustle up customers. But then GDPR was coming down the road, and I thought, okay, you know, hang on, maybe this would be difficult for me to do my traditional way of approaching people. How do I do that? Oh, I know. Why don't I set up an email newsletter and collect some consent via people signing up to it, and then I can open up a channel where I can have a later conversation to sell my software. So yeah, there's origin story number two. I'm not sure which one's true. Probably they both are, but that's basically how it is.
I guess so. Very interesting. And if I take a look at LinkedIn, at your profile, to me, I wondered, have you been always a recruiter? Obviously not. You also co-founded Workshape.io. So you built already another company before, and then you did some other stuff, always related to technology. But how did you come up with the topic recruitment for you?
Do you know what? I actually got into recruitment really by choice. When I sort of graduated from university, in fact, before that, long story short, before I entered university, I was one of these people that was really kind of hostile to the idea of getting a job. So I was a little bit of a teenage hippie where I thought, you know what? I can't imagine myself wearing a shirt and tie, sitting in an office. This seems like complete misery to me. I need to find another path. And of course, I ended up selecting the academic disciplines, which almost was the guarantee that I would not get a job like this. So I chose philosophy, I chose history, I chose anthropology. I ended up doing, which is, you know, studying cultures and tribes and stuff like this. And I thought, okay, minimum case, I'm going to be like an Indiana Jones character and go out in the field. No chance will I ever be an accountant or anything like this. So that was the plan. After I graduated, it became very clear that, you know, I was overly successful in my attempt to sabotage my corporate career, because clearly I had no chance of getting any jobs. And at that time, I was also I finished my journey with academia in a sense, because I became a little bit disillusioned with some of the philosophical groundings behind some of the academic side. I kind of became aware of the, you know, also the problems that can exist in the academic world as well. And I ended up saying, okay, I don't want this. So I need to make some sort of decision. And this is at the time when sort of the Internet 1 was coming around. So this is Web 1 era, early 2000s or so. And that was super exciting. It looked like a brave new world. And I thought, you know what? I need to get into that world somehow. I tried to do some software development early times, you know, trying to do some web page design and development and so on. Let me tell you, Haro, it took me like 3 days to do one page of HTML. And I realized, you know what, I could try really hard to be a programmer, but I'd end up being like seriously mediocre no matter how hard I tried. What is another way for me to get into technology? And then I encountered this job for recruitment. It was like technology recruiter. What is this? It seems that you can help other people get into these companies. Why don't I do that? And maybe, you know, after a year or so, I could recruit myself into one of these cool companies and then figure it out from there. So yeah, that was basically it. Recruitment was basically a surfboard into the world of tech.
That's interesting. So really a learning by doing approach, kind of.
Yes, that was the big pivot that I had from the academic side.
Yes.
So one of the problems I had with academia was that it was so, like, the entire world, even for the courses I was doing, which was studying other people, but the world was internal. You were trying to figure everything out in your mind. And I realized, you know what, actually the only way to do things properly is to embrace the experiences around you and then work it out as you go. And I'm afraid to say I learned that lesson really, really quite late. You know, if I could replay my life and career again, also one of the lessons I would give to myself would be to say, look, there's only so much analysis that can deliver you value. At some point, you need to go and move to action mode, because action will generate you more information that you can then use. And I didn't know that up until all the university. I thought analysis was the only thing that mattered. I could just figure it out if I think hard enough about it. But no, you have to jump into the sea to learn to swim. You know, that's the only way.
That's very funny. There's some parallels also to how I started with Zartcorn. It was mainly I had to read all the stuff anyway, just to know what was going on in the recruitment, but also employer branding scene. And the more I read, the more I felt, hey, I could contribute the interesting things via my blog and later on via the podcast. And doing this, obviously, you learn yourself a lot of stuff. So a talk like this also opens up new ways of thinking, new ideas, and that helps a lot. But that's just a side note. I guess the most people listening to this podcast really would like to know more about your view on how recruitment changed during the last years, but even more so what's happening right now and what are the key drivers for recruitment in the years to come. Especially in this market here, we face a big demographic change. Obviously, we are not the only ones to see that. Then obviously, we have the digitization. And we have also a change of values. At least that's what I see, that people tend to say, I want to work less and have more focus on other things in my life. So that are, at least in my personal view, three drivers that change recruitment a lot, but also working in general a lot. What's your view on this? What happened in the past? Where are we now and where are we heading?
Okay, really interesting. I'm going to use your three ideas, Gero, as basically to answer the question. You might have to remind me what they were, but they were all really interesting. But the last one I'll start with, because that's the one I remember now, which is the change of values in terms of people's attitude to work. Yeah. I think this is true. I think that sort of the COVID period really gave everyone a huge moment of reflection. That was very, very unusual. So if we cast our minds back, you know, now 3 years ago, we were working just all the time, trying to just pound through, let's acquire resources, let's go buy a property, let's, you know, career ladder. That was generally the pathway everyone was talking about. And then boom, guillotine comes down. Everyone is locked down. You know, we have loads of time to think. What's happening here? And you know what? We kind of begin to realize that there's other things that were just much more important to us in terms of our time with ourselves, our times with our family and friends, and so on. These were very powerful things that we learned during that period. I think that we've tried to hold on to those values and bring them into this new reality. However, we're now, I would say, in a moment of tension, and you can even say conflict with the employer side, which I think is trying very hard to bring us back to the pre-2019 era. So for instance, you can argue that the increase of interest rates that was generated from the US Federal Reserve and then cascaded across the rest of the world, as all of the central banks had to follow, that is an attempt really to reduce the personal wealth of the people that they had accumulated during the lockdown and furlough period to make sure that they had become more motivated to continue to do the work that they were doing before.
Oh, that's a very interesting perspective. I never thought about that. So do you think there's a bigger plan behind that, or is it just by accident?
I think there is people that make small numbers of people can make massive decisions which impact hundreds of millions of people in the world. Those, because it's a small number of people, by the way, of which we have no democratic oversight or any democratic way to influence, inevitably those people are going to be susceptible to influence or their own personal agenda. It's not possible for someone to play a completely neutral path to it. If you remember the 2021 period, that was a huge candidate crisis moment. Mm-hmm. Nobody could recruit anybody. Nobody could recruit recruiters. 2021, May 2021, LinkedIn came out with a very famous graph, which it said, you know what, for the first time ever, the most in-demand job on LinkedIn's platform recruiters. Was actually a recruiter.
Yeah.
Now that was the glory period for our industry, in the sense that this is the moment everyone's getting 25-30% pay rises. We were demanding remote. We were demanding, hey, can you pay off my mortgage? Can you provision me with a, you know, a pet insurance, whatever I wanted that people, companies were giving me. So we had a glory period, a desperate moment where we couldn't hire anybody, couldn't hire recruiters. However, the response, I would say, from the other side, from employers per se, or certainly people in charge of the banking system, kind of recognize, you know what, it's not tenable for companies to be unable to recruit people in this way. We need to find a way to really make it easier for companies to recruit and also to reduce the cost of labor to do so. So in other words, they were very concerned about how expensive it was to hire people. How do we do this? I know. Why don't we just stick the interest rates up and take the excess money out of the system and keep racking up until we get to a point where people's financial well-being has been degraded to the point where they're forced to do work that they would have said no to 2021, but they would have said yes to in 2019. That, I think, is the plan behind the interest rate rises.
Very interesting perspective, and brings, at least in my way of thinking, us to my first mentioned point, the demographic change. This is obviously not true for all societies worldwide, but certainly in Europe, it's there. I mean, less kids born like 20 to 30 years ago. And we know exactly how the figures will develop within the next 10 years until, or let's say next 7 years until 2030. So obviously there will always be less people that could be hired than we need probably to be hired. That's my way of thinking. Perhaps you have a completely different perspective to it, because these three topics are related to each other. Yeah, you just mentioned how the situation is right now, but I feel when the economy picks up just a little bit again, very soon we will have similar circumstances as 2021. What's your perspective on this?
On the demographic side, I think that we're starting to mainstream the idea that there is a demographic crisis. So demographers have known this for a long time, but they were always on the margins. We were not talking about it on the mainstream.
Yeah, nobody was interested.
I was totally interested and totally relevant to recruiting. Of course it is.
Yeah.
This is talking about the pipeline. And if you study sort of how economic development works, it's pretty obvious that it is contingent upon reduction of birth rate. And it's one of those contradictions in economic development that I think we're starting to see the potential dangers of. I don't know whether you remember a guy called Hans Rosling. Do you remember this fellow who did these amazing TED Talks and these amazing data visualizations? Are talking about economics, basically. If anybody who hasn't heard of Hans Rosling, just YouTube him and watch some of his videos. Very, very funny guy. But he was also describing what the conditions of economic development were. And it was pretty obvious how you get from a country that is economically impoverished to economically developed. It's one thing that you do. You educate the women. Basically, you educate the women. Women enter the workforce as an educated workforce. That's introducing excess labor into the marketplace. That makes it easier for companies to hire and grow, and prosperity emerges from that. However, what happens at the same moment when you educate women is that they end up having less kids over the course of their lifetime. And in fact, they have less and less kids over the course of their lifetime. So you look at, for instance, the highest birth rate on the world right now is actually Niger. Of course, Niger in the news recently. Birth rate, I think, per woman, I still think it's something like 3 to 4 or something like this, even 5. So quite high. Poorly educated, almost never educated. A woman is at home. They work in purely domestic labor. Only the men work in this way. Therefore, lots of kids emerge. You look at other societies of this type that even exist within modern Western societies, let's say, religious communities, for instance, in the Jewish community, typically lots of kids, women don't go out. Amish community, lots of kids, women don't go out. Even Roman Catholicism, right? Famously, we have a situation where if there is a gender divide, in other words, we have gender roles that are separated, man does this, typically goes into the marketplace, generates revenue, and is an employee. Woman stays at home, looks after the family, looks after the kids, then you have birth rate. Now, in the sort of Western society, we've moved down this route where we don't have this. Women, of course, go and work in equal basis in many cases to men, but the outcome has been a significant decline of birth rate to the point that we're well below the rate of replacement. It needs 2.1 kids per woman, I think, to replace the population. Every country in Western Europe is below that. Every country in Eastern Asia is beyond that. So this is where we know it's not a cultural thing. It is an economic thing. Everyone in Asia, lots of women work in Asia. They're highly educated. They have less kids. So that's a clear pattern. Now, how do we solve this problem? Is it a problem? These are all debates that we can have, probably longer than we need, than we have for this podcast. But we've currently solved it, quote unquote, by using immigration. In other words, we've replaced the workers by getting new people into the country. And in fact, Germany has recently loosened its labor laws, as I understand, immigration laws for lots of different types of non-EU labor sources to doing things like, you know, construction, nursing, teaching, stuff like this. So there's a competition for those resources, bringing those people in. However, is it a long-term solution? Who knows? By the way, the right-wing people that we dislike are the ones that criticize immigration as a solution. And they say, you know what? It's a temporary measure. Actually, we need to figure out why we're not having kids. That's the number one thing we should try and do.
But the solution would be very easy to find, given your arguments 3 minutes ago. Just make sure that women don't work.
Correct. So. But that's obviously not tenable. Right?
Yeah, it's naive. And even if you don't talk about politics, the world changes and we can't switch this back. And we shouldn't, to make this very clear. So I'm totally against the right-wing opinion.
100%. I mean, this is, I would say, it's worth articulating why what the right-wing position is for this reason, though. They want to turn it back. They want to turn it back to the point where actually there is gender division. You know, women can do this, men do that, and then basically have more kids. That's basically the mission for them. Now, we can agree that's not something we're going to do. I don't think anybody would agree that this is the mechanism. Can we do something, though, to kind of arrest the decline of birth rate? And can we do something to increase it somewhat? And I think there's certain ways in which we can do it. So you look at examples where birth rate has increased in Western societies where it's dipped. Actually, the remote working period was a moment where we had a mini bump of people starting to have a little bit more kids than they did before. Why was that? Guess what? They weren't commuting. Two parents were not like commuting 10 hours a week. They weren't coming back exhausted. And you know, they were spending a lot more time together. Guess what? People spend a lot more time together.
At the end of the day, it's about individual flexibility, in my point of view.
It's about basically creating space for the family. Mm-hmm. So the economic systems that we have not been constructed or designed or evolved with any consideration for a family. It treats everybody as an atomic individual with no other responsibilities. Like, you don't even need to have kids. You could have a dog. You could have something you need to take care of. You know what? Your employer back in the pre-COVID days did not sort of cater for this. It didn't cater for the fact you needed to walk your dog. It just said, you're turning up at the office at this time, like everyone else. You're going to leave at the office at this time, like everyone else.
Yeah, that's now, why perhaps also talking about wording, human resources was the wording, which seems a little bit old-fashioned if you have other things in mind, how recruitment, but also work in general could evolve.
This is all about the root from this is all from sort of the industrial era, the Fordian era, yes, of management of resources. That's where the term human resources, exactly, came through. Line manager, why line? Of course, that's the assembly line. So we even use the terminology still to this day. But of course, you know, we're not atomic workers in the traditional sense in many cases. And in fact, when we talk about AI, the most defensible work that we do is actually the collaborative work with other human beings. That is the antithesis of line assembly work. It's not where you're doing one thing over and over and over again. You're actually collaborating in kind of ill-defined type of projects, and then the solution emerges from the collaboration. That type of work, we need a new kind of management. We need a new type, maybe even a new type of organization that caters for that group of people. Now, hopefully we can create these new structures that actually are pro-family, pro-people, pro-women, let's face it, because the atomic style of management has been definitely default against the man. The man is the template. Women have always had to do things with a handicap simply because the system was designed as if everyone was a man. So the future needs to be, okay, let's think about everyone more as collaborators. Let's think about them holistically as individuals that have relationships. Let's have a think about, you know, who are they as people. I hope we can get there, but it's an ambition I think we need to fight for.
But I think this is or might be linked to the third topic, digitization. How can technology help to achieve this world? Or in other words, if we talk about jobs and job profiles, what kind of jobs will decease, and what kind of new jobs or better skills will be more important? If you talk about that, it's quite clear that probably it's more about empathy and really being able to work with others, come up with new solutions and use technology to help get rid of standard procedures, which at the moment still take a lot of time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as we know more about where technology is going, we can understand the certain areas that, and here when we talk about technology, I specifically refer to artificial intelligence, and mm-hmm. where that might kind of change the sort of skills or the work that human beings will do. But there's three main areas I think we can talk about there. Number one, where is all the artificial intelligence that we're currently using and we're dazzled by? They've all been trained on documented information. ChatGPT has been trained basically on billions of internet pages. That's documentation. But if you think about a lot of the conversations, a lot of the information that is exchanged between human beings, that's never documented. The conversations you have with your manager, the one-to-one you have with that individual, maybe the workshop you do with a bunch of colleagues, or the quick whiteboarding you're doing with, you know, another team. A lot of that stuff is not digitized, not documented, and therefore it cannot be pumped into any language model. So have a think about where in your process there is non-documented information. A classic example of this, by the way, when you're having a conversation with a candidate, a lot of the stuff there, you're not going to record. It's like mm-hmm. the private stuff that's really important, kind of off the record, but it makes the difference in terms of, okay, this is what Hung really wants, okay? Can we provide something in this way for him? And then that's the skill of the recruiter to be able to nuance that information out.
That's interesting. And I have a very strong belief that at the end of the day, given all technology which we have now, but also in the future, at the end of the day, people will decide for or against people. So humans will be talking to humans at the end of the process. That's at least what I think. It might be remote, like we do it right now, yes. But I doubt that the whole process will be done totally automated. It could be done from a technological point of view, but I don't think that this will be true in the future.
I think that is true. I agree with you, but it's going to be job specific. So in other words, certain jobs I think will be fully automated, or the process to hire them will be fully automated. We've already seen some evidence of this. And again, there is a social hierarchy as to what these jobs are. So yes. The jobs, let's say, that are, I would hate to say low skill, but you could probably describe them that way, where, you know, the barrier to entry is quite low. Basically, anybody who's prepared to actually do the job for this period of time can go and grab it. That type of work, I think we've already seen examples where there's heavy automation throughout the entire process to get that person through the door. Where it will not be automated is exactly where the function of the job is less defined. There's high collaboration intensity. So this is a term I think the listeners might like. Collaboration intensity. Have a think about the jobs where it actually involves working with other people at a high degree. And actually, you cannot do it by yourself for a long time, whatever that may be. It turns out that's quite a lot of the white collar work that we're doing.
Oh, yeah.
White collar work, you know, knowledge work, etc. So I think that for that type of recruiting, for that type of worker, for sure, the context of the team you'll be joining will be a significant component of the decision making. It's not something you could take out of the process.
I completely agree. Given our timing, unfortunately, the time is almost up. I'm so sad about this, but we will have another discussion in the future for sure. I will mention it later on. My last question to you in this session would be, what inspired you during the last weeks? Is there something that happened that made you think that you might want to share with the listeners here?
Yes. I would actually extend it beyond a few weeks. So I work in a fairly digital way. I think similar to you, man, it's like essentially you could do everything from your own home, right? So I at the start of this year, I got into a little bit of a habit of being so efficient, quote unquote, that I resented just leaving my house, because I thought, oh, that's going to take me an hour to get here. It's going to do, the day's gone. It's, you know, I could do X amount of work, do whatever. So I was in that mode. And then I realized, okay, you're in danger here of just becoming over-optimized for efficiency. And what you want to do is to create space in your day so that you can encounter things you don't expect. And that is going out and interacting with other human beings. So I made it a rule that I'm going to leave the property every day, and I'm going to just try and speak to people on the street. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm going to have conversations with people. The guy who I'm buying stuff, you know, from the shop, you know what? I'm going to have a chat with him. Or, you know, I'm going to walk through, I see the dog, I'm going to pet the dog and have a chat with the dog walker. That kind of activity. Is it efficient? No, it ain't, because I don't know how long that conversation is or whatever. But it is so enriching, because what happens there is that you get an unexpected exchange with a person who you don't know whether is a friend or not, but it allows you to basically experience a bit of surprise and a bit of non-predictability in your life, and you just don't know whether there's any positives to come out of that. What I get from it, it's almost like a shock to the system, to the lazy system, and you're suddenly more alert, you're suddenly happier, and you're suddenly able to just be more on a plus. So if you think about, you know, happiness, I mean, I'm not a mental health expert whatsoever, so please take what I'm about to say with the caveats that it needs. But I kind of wake up and I think, okay, am I going to be a plus to the universe today, or am I going to be a minus to the universe today? And if it's a minus, I actually decide, okay, I probably shouldn't speak to anybody, because I'm just going to drag other people down with my misery. So I'm going to stop doing that. But I'm going to get, if I'm a plus, I'm going to go out there. But anyway, what happens is, the more you go out there, the more pluses you feel. And I think it is very contagious. I think it is a virtuous cycle where your positive engagement with the human beings creates more positivity, and then you're on a roll. It's very difficult to come away from that. And I think the opposite is also true. So if you're on a misery doom loop, your behaviors will start encouraging more misery. And then before you know it, all you can do is the misery. So what's inspired me is basically interacting with other people, particularly individuals I've never met before, like the people on the street. Go and speak to people on the street.
Oh, thank you very much for this inspirational idea. At the end, it sounds a little bit also like leaving the comfort zone and make sure to interact. And yeah, we have the chance to interact at least once again next year on the Embrace Festival, since you will be part of this. I'm really looking forward to have you on the festival in 2024. But now, thanks a lot that you took half an hour to talk to me. I wish you all the best with recruiting BrainFood. I really suggest every listener to check it out. And it was a pleasure talking to you. Thanks, Hang.
Thank you, everybody. Great to be on the show. And I look forward to seeing everybody next year.
Yeah, me too. Bye-bye. Jo, das war diese Saatkorn-Podcast-Episode. Wenn du nichts mehr verpassen willst und dich überhaupt für die Saatkorn-Themen interessierst, dann abonnier doch einfach meinen niegelnagelneuen Newsletter. Und dann bekommst du jeden Sonntag frisch alle Artikel, alle Podcast-Folgen, außerdem noch meine wöchentliche Kolumne und die Verlosung der Woche in deine Inbox. Musst du natürlich nicht sonntags lesen, geht auch montags oder dienstags. Ich würde mich sehr freuen, hier nochmal die URL saatkorn.com/newsletter. Tja, dann bis bald. Ciao.